Hello, and welcome back to The Powerful Patient. This is Joyce Graff. Today we're going to talk with the founders of a new nonprofit organization called Global Cures. Global Cures is proposing to work on new therapies for cancer, and this is not to develop drugs, but rather to take existing drugs or herbal compounds or other methodologies that might help with cancer, but that have not yet gotten approval by the FDA for use with cancer, because there's no drug company that's willing to undertake the approval process. It takes a tremendous amount of money to bring a drug to market here. Even after it's been developed, it can cost about $10 million to get through the clinical trials and FDA registration process. In order to undertake that process, most drug companies want to make sure that they're going to be able to earn back at least $100 million from the sale of this drug. Now, in order to do that, they're going to need some patent protection in the beginning so that nobody else can compete with them in the selling of this drug and that they'll get a favorable price. So anything that they can't patent becomes a lot less desirable. And that means all of the herbal compounds. It also means some of the drugs that are already on the market, they may already be in a generic phase. Why would they want to pay to bring it to market as a cancer drug? I'll be right back with Dr. and Mrs. Sukatmi after this brief message. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Please read about us at our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of one of our CDs that we use on the programming. And again, the site is powerfulpatient.org.
I'm Vikas Sukathme. I'm in my professional life, I'm Chief Academic Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And I'm founder of this organization, Global Cures.
Global Cures. And Vidula?
Hi. Yes, I'm Vidula Sukathme, and I'm a founder of the Global Cures Nonprofit Medical Research Institute as well.
Now, see, you have an MS in what?
I have a master's in epidemiology.
So you guys are well grounded in academics and in drug development from the traditional medical side. And I see that through Global Cures, you want to take a different kind of look at not only the drugs that are developed through that process, but also perhaps at some of the more traditional medicines. So could you tell me a little bit about that effort?
Basically, the organization, as Vidula was saying, is a not-for-profit. It's a medical research organization, and the focus is on bringing novel cancer therapies to patients. The initial focus will be exclusively in cancer, but later we hope to extend this to other diseases as well. And we will be looking to identify both conventional drugs that already exist, as well as other substances that have scientific merit as a possible therapy for cancer, but are not being pursued by the pharmaceutical companies because they lack an adequate financial reward.
Mm-hmm.
And usually this is the case because either the drugs have no longer a patent position. So in other words, the patents may have expired, or the drugs were never patented in the first place.
The patent means that there's a bigger margin on it. They can charge more, right?
Right. So basically, as I'm sure most people are aware, drug development really occurs in two steps. The first step is traditionally in the laboratory, and it's funded typically by the government. And the second step is in the clinic. In other words, these drugs undergo human trials, and typically industry funds these trials. The trials are expensive. And so to recover the costs of these trials, pharmaceutical companies typically want to have a patent protection, so only they can sell the drug if it were to come to the market, and so that they can charge adequately to recover the costs of the trials. So in other words, what may be scientifically promising must first have patent protection, as well as address perhaps a large enough market and a few other criteria before a drug company develops it. So ideas that may not be completely orthodox, ideas that may be high risk, or drugs that don't have patent protection, all of these might be shunned by the pharmaceutical sector. And that's really the niche in which Global Cures wishes to assert itself.
So traditionally, the drug companies have looked for what they call blockbuster drug, one that they could sell to just about anybody, you know, the new aspirin or something, so that they can sell a zillion of them and make a whole bunch of money. But medicine is moving in a different direction now. We're talking about personalized medicine, and so the markets for each individual drug are getting smaller. And one of the things I've found kind of frustrating is they keep looking for the silver bullet. You know, if it isn't the silver bullet that they can sell to tons and tons of people, they're less interested in taking that to market.
Right, that is correct. In fact, from what I understand, there's almost this $100 million profit quoted in several articles, which suggest that if the company feels that they will not make more than $100 million, they will not be interested in developing that further.
Now, the majority of people who are grappling with cancer are usually grappling with a tumor that has already metastasized, that they're in a fast race for taking care of this tumor and hunting down the mets in order to survive. But that's less and less true as we go forward because we're identifying cancers at earlier stages. And one of the criteria that I've heard used is that the tumor has to shrink or the drug is considered a failure. But if you have small tumors, controlling that tumor, what they call stable disease in the trade, could be a very attractive endpoint.
Right, right. So absolutely. I mean, this is a more general sort of question. We, from our standpoint, that is a way to live. If you have stable disease and it's not causing much morbidity, you can live for long periods of time if the therapy... Therapy may have to be given chronically, and if its side effects are relatively minor, one could, in fact, live with that disease. So cancer in certain kinds might become a chronic disease, and from the Global Cure standpoint, we really don't care. In other words, we'll do what we think is the best, is in the best interests of patients with the drugs or the type of drugs that would be available to us. Let me also add that we might combine some of these drugs with drugs that are on patent and are being used for cancer therapy to make those drugs even more efficacious. So in that sense, we're not in any way necessarily antagonistic to what's already going on. We may add to it in a very positive way by combining some drugs together with current standard of care.
Let's talk about a couple of examples. You had a very interesting example on your website about a breast cancer trial, some of the things you might do that would complement some of the existing therapies and maybe make them more powerful and more effective.
Right, so I'll give you some examples. One type of drug that we're looking at very carefully right now and is probably in our top 10 in terms of moving forward with a clinical protocol, which literally could start tomorrow if we had the funding, would be the cholesterol-lowering drug, the statins. And statins are the number one selling drugs in the world at the moment, one particular statin, atorvastatin. And these are used to lower cholesterol. It turns out there are 1,000 articles on statins and cancer, and most are epidemiology studies. But there are a significant number of them that have looked both in cell culture studies and in animal studies, and there are a handful of human trials in cancer where statins were given mostly alone, not with chemotherapy. There have been some trials where it was given with chemotherapy for very short periods of time, and there are some very promising results. This is out there. It's in the literature. But
now, when you say that most of them are epidemiology studies, tell me about that. What does it mean?
So there the question is, if you're on statins for lowering your cholesterol for heart disease, do you have a greater incidence of cancer or a lesser incidence of cancer? And what's interesting is there are a number of studies in a number of cancer types which show that a long-term use of statins actually diminishes your chances of developing cancer. Now, that does not necessarily inform you about how you could use statins acutely, that is, for short periods of time.
Right. So if you have a cancer tumor, could you use it as a therapy? And that's an unknown. But if you're taking them for other reasons, it seems to lower your chances of getting a cancer. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. But it's not completely unknown as to what would happen if you were to take a statin as a therapy. There is data in, again, largely in animals, in which tumors implanted in animals treated with statins plus chemotherapy, the tumors grow much less fast than they grow on chemotherapy alone or the controls alone.
Huh.
So there is animal data. There's even some human data. For example, there is data in acute myelogenous leukemia. And in this case, the statins were given for a few days just prior to standard of care induction chemotherapy. This is published in the journal Blood, which is one of the top journals in the world, in the area of leukemias and lymphomas and so on. And the investigators are at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, among other institutions. So this was a phase one trial, really to look at the safety of this procedure, that is giving the statins in fairly high doses for a few days prior to giving the chemotherapy. And the article ends by pointing out that this was quite safe, but ends by saying that the number of patients who went into remission was so much higher than they expected that it's now time to do a phase two or perhaps even go directly to a phase three randomized trial.
Now, why would that not be of interest to the pharmaceutical company? I mean, they want to sell more of these statin drugs. Why not be interested in an additional application?
All right. So first of all, if they could patent the use of statins in cancer, you might argue that it might be of interest to them. Now, it turns out these papers have been published for many, many years. So the chances of submitting a patent now on statins in cancer is very small. You can submit a use patent, but there the biggest problem is enforcement. It'd be very difficult to enforce such a patent because the statins, once they turn generic, meaning their patent is expired, it'd be very hard really to track who's you know ordering it for cancer therapy and who's ordering it for cardiovascular reasons. But most importantly, the market for cardiovascular indications is huge.
Right.
It is a large market. And it is a chronic market. You're on statins for life, more or less, unless you
right.
have side effects. The statin market in cancer, relatively speaking, is minuscule. So for all of these reasons, the drug companies will not pursue this.
Huh.
It's very simple when you really come down to it.
Yeah, it all comes down to money.
It comes down right. to money. And so the only way you could pursue this is if you wrote a grant to the federal government, meaning typically the NIH, and if the National Institutes of Health were to fund it. Now, that's a possibility. The other possibility would be to appeal to any of the foundations, such as the American Cancer Society or the Susan Komen Foundation or the Lymphoma Leukemia Society, and they may be able to fund it. But typically, these cost a fair amount of money, and there are ways of saving some of those costs, but we can come back to. But typically, these organizations, as large as they may be, have not taken the position of funding highly translatable research, which is what this is. In other words, things that could go into action tomorrow to help patients. They have largely funded basic science. And we believe that's a gap. We believe that should be remedied.
What about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation?
Well, so it's interesting you ask. There have been a number of people who have asked us about this, and the good news is we have a number of folks who are willing to connect us to them. For the most part, the Gates Foundation has not funded projects in cancer. They have largely funded diseases that affect the third world, Though one could argue, and this is the approach that we intend to take, two things. One is that the third world is developing cancer at a very rapidly increasing rate, number one. And number two, if we were to succeed in any of the therapies that we propose, it would be very cheap compared to the therapies or the latest therapies in cancer, for example. So I think on the affordability issue, we might be able to make some headway.
We're going to take a little break here, and we'll be back to talk some more about the affordability of new therapies for cancer. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides there for this show with more information about the people we're speaking with, the websites that we've referenced, and other background material on this topic. And as always, we would appreciate your support. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're back now speaking with Vikas and Vidula Sukhatme of the Global Cures Foundation.
The new drugs are wicked expensive, and so if you can come up with alternatives that are much more affordable, that's good for everybody, and not only in the United States, but even more so in the third world.
Right. So one of the approaches we are taking is actually we are trying to contact governments of India and China, because they might be interested in developing these as affordable therapies. And we are hoping that they will actually be willing to conduct some of these trials abroad. One of the points I actually wanted to make, and it is something that I was not aware of at all when I started this organization, is the fact that clinical research and clinical trials is just not funded by anybody but pharmaceutical companies at this time. All these huge foundations, and NIH included, they have made a conscious decision to actually fund basic research, and there are very, very, very few grants available basically to fund clinical trials, which this is a point that I was absolutely not aware of, and I don't know how many people out there are aware of this fact.
Right.
Most of the money that, so when you actually donate money to American Cancer Society or Susan Komen, most of that money is actually going to basic research.
Right, and I'll give you one example. I don't know how well this fits in with what you all are doing, but some years ago there was a lot of noise about shark cartilage. Sharks don't get cancer. And so a number of people in who have von Hippel-Lindau disease picked up on this and said, maybe I should take shark cartilage and it would keep my tumors from growing. So we looked around to try to find some guidance on it, and there were no articles, there were no clinical trials, nothing. So we kind of agreed that the people who wanted to go on it would at least report their results to us. And part of the problem was that when people do that on a somewhat casual basis, I'll sign up for it, you don't get the scientific before information and you don't get the scientific after information. So you really don't know if you're adding up apples and oranges or and bananas or what. But the bottom line was that most of the people who were taking it did have increased tumor growth. And so we were able to say, you know, this is not a dramatic cure. But it would have been better if there had been more of a scientific evaluation.
Yeah, so Joyce, one of the things that we are very keen on doing is even though our first group of drugs will probably be ones in which we do have clear-cut targets known, so we know what the statins generally do, we know what the molecular targets are, we will probably work with single agents in which the mechanism of action is fairly well defined. It just hasn't been capitalized on for cancer therapy. But we also are very interested in compounds, in mixtures or herbal products or other things, extracts. There are issues there. In other words, how do you standardize? To what do you standardize since you don't know the active ingredient and so on and so forth? So there are those serious issues about quality control and so on. However, we don't intend to let those things just sort of slip by. Again, going back to patients, trying to look at what some of their experiences have been, even though this may not be in the very highest priority for us right now, just because there's so much low-lying fruit right now to you know, move forward with, mm-hmm. in which these issues don't arise. Nevertheless, we will be paying attention to these kinds of things. And Vidula and I and some of our colleagues who are, you know, helping us out have built up a repertoire of nearly, you know, literally several hundred papers that look at some of the most exotic ideas, if you will, from around the world in cancer therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And in our travels to India and China and near the Mexican border and so on and so forth and by phone, we're accumulating this information. When and how we act on it will really depend on you know, where we are on funding. But there's a lot of very interesting things out there, and those practicing them, unfortunately, are so distant from the typical oncology community. It's really sad because they're doing whatever they're doing. The oncology community is doing whatever they're doing. And I'm not taking any sides here as to who's right and who's wrong. It's just that they don't talk with each other.
And no, they kind of sneer at each other many times.
That's correct. That's correct. And each accuses the other in different ways of, you know, not doing things in the best interest of patients and so on and so on and so forth.
Right.
We're doing our best to be completely objective. And, in fact, there are some in the oncology community who believe that we'll have a hard road ahead because some oncologists may not want to work with us because once they work with these compounds, they will enroll patients in these trials and may not enroll patients in, you know, in pharmaceutical trials. On the other hand, those who practice some of these more arcane things, some of them are not necessarily in favor of working with us because if we were to show some of what they're doing doesn't work, they may lose their business. So it's kind of a very interesting road here that we're up against or mm-hmm. trying to follow. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we have belief that we're now living in a very different century where patients are very powerful, and you know, your radio program of the powerful patient is exactly what we want to capitalize on. We want patients to support this because we believe it is in their best interest. And we're not on anybody's side other than the patient's side.
Right, and when you have a serious illness, if any port in a storm, you know, all ideas are very welcome. And everything from taking vitamins to using magnets or going to acupuncture or chiropractic, whatever makes you feel better, whatever has a benefit, is definitely a candidate for consideration. But we do want somebody to help us choose what is a wise choice and what is just a waste of your money. And that's a very hard thing to find.
Right. Well, and it's not just a waste of your money. I mean, most of these people don't have enough time to try everything either. If they have 6 to 8 months, they have to try something. They can only try one or two therapies, so they don't want to waste their time trying something that's not going to work for them.
Right.
Which is one reason we've indicated, I think it's on our website, but we do point this out to the people we're talking with, that even if several of our trials were not to work, it would at least tell people not to do those things.
Right.
That itself, we believe, in a disease such as cancer, where time is critical, as Vidula said, and as you know, we believe is an important service right in itself.
Right.
But I do want to come back to your issue of integrative therapies. Or alternatives or different kinds of therapies. For example, the notion that the mind in some way can affect tumor growth is, you know, something that's been in the literature for a while. There's no data really one way or the other. There is some data first suggesting that, you know, support groups and so on might help. Then there's data contradicting that. But what is very interesting is that data is starting to emerge in animals. There's a paper in a very distinguished journal within the last 6 months that showed that tumors implanted in mice who were stressed by putting them in a small chamber for half an hour, those tumors grew faster mm-hmm. than tumors in mice who were not so stressed. And in particular, they were able to identify a pathway, a neuroendocrine pathway, by which this occurs. So, and there's a drug. And there's a drug that if you give to the mice, even when they're stressed, the tumor doesn't grow faster anymore. And uh-huh. There is a beautiful example. It's in a top journal, Nature Medicine, of an example where stress induces cancer growth.
Right.
And there's a drug.
To block it.
And nobody's going to trust that. I can assure you of that, because the drug costs a few pennies every day.
Oh, my goodness. So tell us what it is. No.
Well, it's basically a beta blocker. It blocks the... So part of stress is the release of a series of molecules called catecholamines, and this is basically a blocker of that catecholamine response. So they're called beta blockers. Now, it turns out there's a certain kind of beta blocker that one could potentially try.
Yeah.
But this is where science is going. But these beta blockers are pretty cheap.
Well, you know, one of the things that comes up in my mind is, could you all design a kind of volunteer trial? Is there some way that we could, for an inexpensive cost, have a number of, you know, we could probably get hundreds of volunteers who would take this, obviously in conjunction with whatever other things that they were doing to treat their cancers, but is it possible to design an inexpensive trial, or is a clinical trial by its nature an expensive undertaking?
It doesn't have to be as expensive as it's made out to be. And part of what the drug companies do is that because the failure rate is what it is, meaning quite high, and we can talk more about that, in a way, those numbers that you hear, that it costs $1 billion roughly now to bring a drug to the market, takes into account the number of trials that have failed. So one way we can get an advantage in global cures is that some of the failures, for example, occur in phase one trials because there's too much toxicity. A phase one trial, its main goal is to figure out how much of a drug you can take without getting nasty side effects. Now, one of the nice things about the drugs that we're talking about is that they've been used in some cases in millions and millions of patients. So the complication for us is what would happen if they were combined in odd or different ways. And so we'd have to redo some of the phase one trials, admittedly, with combinations that we're particularly excited about for cancer. But there is a huge safety record. And so we actually decrease the chances of failure for many of the compounds that we're talking about.
Right. So safety is pretty well known. Now we need to know how effective it is by itself or in combination with other drugs.
That's exactly right. So what we're saying is we may have to repeat some of the phase one data, the safety data, because the combinations might be novel and they may not have been tested together.
Mm-hmm.
Could probably move fairly rapidly from, not probably, almost definitively, move fairly rapidly from there to efficacy studies, meaning phase two trials. And so I think we could save on monies that way. The other ways is that a lot of times in clinical trials, scientists do not incorporate the most sophisticated biomarkers, in other words, surrogate measures of whether something is or isn't, might or might not work.
So give us an example of that.
So for example, let's say I had a technique, I had some fancy magnetic resonance imaging technique that allowed me to tell you 2 weeks into the use of an anti-angiogenic drug. So this is as you know, this is an area that I've worked in quite a bit when, you know, we've interacted in our kidney cancer program.
Right.
There is actually a radiologic test which at 2 to 3 weeks can predict with pretty good accuracy whether, in fact, the patient's tumor is going to shrink as measured 2 months later by a standard CT scan. Now, you might argue, why haven't the drug companies done this? Well, they should, and some of this is cutting-edge science, and they may or may not find that it's worth putting in that those extra tests because they're doing a phase one trial, and this is really what they would do in a phase two. But for mm-hmm. global cures, if we think this is the right thing to do, we might incorporate this even in a phase one, and therefore learn a lot more information even in the phase one trial. So you might think it's more expensive, but it may turn out to be less expensive in the long run by putting in very sophisticated tests fairly early on in the game.
Because also, it would shorten the trial.
Exactly. We could put that exactly.
We're speaking with Vikas and Vidula Sukhatme, who are the founders of Global Cures. And we'll be back to speak more with them after these messages about some other examples of the conflict between benefit and cost in developing and certifying drugs.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. and Mrs. Sukhatme, founders of Global Cures.
There is a drug that's used for non-small cell lung cancer, and it blocks, it's called an EGF receptor blocker, and it basically works in about 10% of the cases. Now, the drug company spent millions of dollars getting the drug approved in hundreds and hundreds of patients treated. And they needed enough patients to show that in 10% of them they got some effect. So they needed tons of patients, and the trial was very expensive. Now, at this point, they're not interested in knowing which 10% the drug works in. Unless the drug has a lot of toxicity, they don't want to know because their market would fall tenfold.
Now, the global so they want to sell it to the 100% of people, even though they know that only 10% of the people are going to benefit.
Well, they did the trial. And having done the trial, they found 10% of the patients benefit.
Right.
So the drug was approved. In non-small cell lung cancer, that drug was approved. Now, the Global Cures view of this would be the following. We would try to figure out, based on certain science, which patients ahead of time might be the likely ones to benefit. And the likely ones are ones in which this pathway, this signaling pathway that this drug affects, is messed up. Those are the patients in which it's likely the drug will work. So
And this is something that's been done in other diseases. For example, it's been done in pediatric leukemia. So if you have somebody with leukemia, they've only got a certain amount of time during which you can treat them before they're going to die. So if you choose the wrong drug, let's say they're one of this 90% that are not going to benefit from the drug you're talking about, they are losing precious time, and they could run out of time or die before we find the right drug. So it's very important to identify up front whether, you know, if you've got drugs A, B, C, D, E, is drug D going to be better for this patient than B? If we knew that ahead of time, we could save that precious time.
So the Global Cures perspective on this is exactly what you're saying. It's very simple. We don't care at the end of the day whether the drug sells a lot or doesn't sell a lot. If it helps the right patient who needs it, that's it. So from a Global Cures perspective, we will put in those criteria up front in our trials and therefore potentially save enormous amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that compound, that drug, sells a lot or doesn't sell a lot is a moot point. Now, in fairness to the drug companies, the newer trials that they're designing, assuming they haven't done the larger trial, and assuming that they're not necessarily saying that we have to have a $1 billion market, some of the drug companies are moving and are accepting a smaller market and are willing, therefore, to give their drug to a smaller number of people whom they think it'll benefit in because they know it'll cost less to develop that drug. So in fairness to them, some of them are now coming on board.
Well, there is a model here, and the rare disease model, because we have gotten some of the pharmaceuticals to develop drugs for small markets, for people with rare diseases, by giving them some financial incentives or whatever, and really making an impact there. You're talking about some of the drugs that aren't even patentable, so maybe even one of the generics would be willing to undertake something if we could make it affordable enough.
Well, so you're asking, could we not go to some of the generic drug companies to help in some of this effort?
Right.
And it's interesting because, again, this issue has come up. So here's the problem. If there's generic drug company A, and it's making the generic statin, for example, that we're interested in using, that company, if it were to fund the trial, and if the trial were to work, there's nothing immediately to stop Company B from making that generic compound immediately, as soon as they know the trial works.
Right.
And they will have spent no money on it, and Company A will have.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, Company A says no deal.
Right. Okay.
Well, now
let me ask you another question. Since you're talking with the governments of China and India, it's a lot less expensive to run a clinical trial in China or India. And again, if we can design a trial that's inexpensive enough, we might be able to do it. Here's what's in the back of my mind. For example, when we have a drug trial going on right now in Texas for von Hippel-Lindau disease. So it's one site in the United States testing one drug for one rare disease. And they would like to recruit patients. Well, now the patients, you understand, are all over the United States. And so if they want to participate in this trial, they have to go once a month to Houston, pay their own airfare, pay their own hotel bill, take time off from work and family to go and participate in this trial. So it's a royal pain in the neck. The reason that they want to have a single site is so that they can have the same doctors, the same MRI machine, the same radiologist reading the scans in order to keep the data consistent. And while I understand that, for some of these, would it not be possible to design something that you could do with your local GP and somehow pool data in a meaningful way?
The answer is absolutely yes. We would be very interested. In fact, we're starting to explore with some software companies how we would best run this. And in fact, the extension of this is, I think, where you were initially, and that is sort of the concept of the virtual trial almost.
Right.
So let me just take this in two parts. One is the possibility that we put a protocol on the web, and even before we got it funded, for example, there would be some physicians out there and some patients out there who might be willing, given that there is a protocol at least, might be willing to prescribe these medications. They would be absolutely legally correct in doing so because they have run out of other options. But they would still be a little wary because they might get sued, they might be worried about their peers and what they might say. But most importantly, they really don't know the side effects, and they really don't know how to optimize the doses. And that's, of course, all the reasons why we want to do a formal clinical trial. However, short of that, or before that all got underway, we are inclined, once we have settled on a protocol, to actually put it on the web. And that's where this virtual trial concept could come in. Some physician in Texas may see it. Somebody in China may see it. Somebody in Atlanta may see it. And, you know, even the anecdotal data that would come back, in my opinion, serves to generate hypotheses. It may not be perfect. It doesn't prove anything.
Right.
But it's worth data capturing. It's worth capturing that data. And so we are trying to work with some people who might enable us to do that. So I think you're right on. I think we have to know what its limitations are, know the limitations of the method, but I think you're right on.
Well, here's another twist to that. Because there's only one site in the United States, there are a number of people who are taking this drug with, under the supervision of their local doctor as off-label use. All the information, all the learning from that patient's experience is lost. There's no way to add that into the clinical trial. So, and I've been talking with the drug company, I've been talking with the research team, and while they're willing to assemble it as you say, anecdotal data, you know, it's just sort of third-hand information, it's not scientifically collected, nonetheless, there's important learning there that I'd like to corral in one place. And similarly, if we're talking about off-label use of existing drugs that your normal GP could prescribe, it seems to me that we need some systematic way to collect that information and have a volunteer able to contribute data in a meaningful way.
Right. So that is actually what I'm looking at, talking to some software companies, because the issue is that we have to design a almost like a form on the web so that the physicians treating these one and two people off-site have a formal format to input the data in.
Right, and it's, of course, important to collect the data in a consistent way, but it would also be important to have that protocol that says, look, before you start taking this drug, have the following scans, the following blood tests, collect three tubes like this and send them to this central repository, whatever it takes to try to make the data consistent.
Right, so that is the whole point, that once we get a protocol written and on the web, then this data collection sheet makes a lot of sense, because a lot of people then using the drug will follow that protocol. Mm-hmm. And as you're saying, we will start getting, you know, pre-values and post-values and things like that, which will make it a lot more, robust than what you get if you just have people put in whatever they wanted.
Right.
I don't know if you're familiar with the drug DCA.
No.
The site called the DCA. .com site, and this was started by somebody who wanted to sell this drug DCA, which was, and Vikas can tell you more about the science behind it, but somebody did exactly what you are suggesting, that they just started the site and patients are posting their experiences, because these people are taking it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the response of the patients, it's very scary, because there are people taking it who are getting really strong reactions without the help of anybody, monitoring them.
Right.
And yes, there are some lessons to be learned from that, but they're not as good as if somebody actually made a proper format and a proper trial protocol for them to try, so that the physicians could actually monitor them with the patient. So that is what we're looking at to see if we can actually get to that point for Global Cures.
That would be great.
And I think it would want to be individualized to the type of cancer. So for the VHL patients, the kind of record that you want to keep is somewhat different than in a breast cancer patient, for example.
Right.
So one of the things we're trying to do is to try to get a template that would make sense for this patient versus that. And we intend to, as one of the services of this organization, put that on the web. The point is to just make this available. So. So people can do that. Again, recognizing its limitations, but also recognizing that it's better than just people haphazardly saying, I took this and I took this and, you know, I did it for 10 days, then I got tired and then I felt sleepy and then my doctor said, by the way, you're stupid and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Right.
So if it's just recorded in a proper template, I think it'll go a long ways. And there are many physicians who are willing to work under those circumstances if they're given some guidance.
Yes, if they're given the guidance.
Right.
And I think they need an easy tool to keep their records. And so if you could provide it on the web, I think that would make it a lot easier for people to do
that. That sounds great.
We'll be back in just a moment to speak more with Vikas and Vidula Sukatmi from the Global Cures Foundation. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find there the program guide for this show with information about the people we've interviewed, the websites that we've mentioned, and other background on this topic. And as always, we will appreciate your good support. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Stay with us now and we'll be right back. We're back now with Vikas and Vidula Sukatmi, founders of the Global Cures Foundation, talking about clinical trials.
Let me ask you another question about clinical trials. It's becoming more and more of an issue. Most clinical trials want to simplify the questions that they're trying to answer. We have a tumor. It's 5 centimeters. It got bigger or smaller in the course of things. And so that's a fairly simple answer to obtain. But people who have multiple problems are often excluded from clinical trials. And And while I can understand that from a certain perspective, the real world is that a lot of people have multiple problems, and especially as the population is aging, you have more and more older people with cancer who probably also have an extra medical problem or two in the same human being. So how do we make sure that the answers we get from these sort of rarefied clinical trials are actually going to play out in a meaningful way in the real population?
Well, that's a very tough question, Joyce. This kind of tension always exists, right? I mean, you want to pick patients with the least comorbid conditions in order to make the trial as pure, quote-unquote, as possible to interpret.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, we know what you're just saying. That is, in the real world, those populations, you know, represent only a small fraction of those who have the disease, and then we end up extrapolating for the remaining ones. So that's a tough one. I don't know quite how to answer it. I guess I could say that if any of those considerations are financial ones, those would not enter into the way we would look at things. I can't say that they are or not. Some of them are scientific, but some may be financial. And so that at least wouldn't enter into our thinking.
What do you mean some of them may be financial?
In other words, it might just be easier to, it might be cheaper to run a trial in a certain subset of patients, but that may not necessarily represent the larger group of patients. For example, do cholesterol-lowering drugs really help males with high cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, who are above 65? It turns out if you really slice and dice and you really push the cardiologist to the wall, some of them may tell you that the trials didn't really address that subgroup. And that's a pretty big subgroup, right?
Right.
Whereas the people who entered into those trials were younger and you know, and so on and so forth. So what you're asking is that for a variety of reasons, the trial may have been done in a certain way, but it doesn't necessarily apply to those in which you really want to ask the question. So there's always this tension, but
right.
The drug company may have decided that it's, you know, the quickest way to get this to the market is in a certain population. Once it's there, others will extrapolate and start using it. But then somebody reanalyzes the data and finds out, whoops, we didn't have any patients who were above 80 and, you know, who are now being treated in this way.
Right. I think that we need to be careful, though, that when we design a trial, we don't sort of design ourselves into a corner. You know, we want to have people who meet the following 8 characteristics, and by the time you get to the end of that list, you're left with about 3% of the people who have this disease who would qualify.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. So I think we will tend to be, in the way we run these things, we'll tend to be a little more inclusive, maybe a lot more inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit less purist. I'll give you a very, very, you know, concrete example here. Most cancer trials, there has to be a period of where the drug, the chemotherapy, has been discontinued for a certain period of time before they get onto a certain trial. And that, depending on the drug, can be 2 weeks or 4 weeks.
So if you've taken drug A, then
right.
You have to be off it for 4 weeks before you can take drug B. Is that what you mean?
Right. And B is the one you're going to go on the trial on.
Right.
Now, there is a rationale for this, and that is that the effects of drug A may last for a period of time.
Right.
So you don't want that bias in there. You want a clean slate. That's the rationale, the scientific rationale.
Mm-hmm.
Flip side of this is one that I'm sure we can also appreciate, and that is that there's precious time being lost.
Right.
And during that time, the tumor may be growing. The patient may have other problems and, you know, and so on and so forth. So in our group of people that we're talking with, there are some of us who feel that we won't necessarily be as scientifically rigorous maybe in our very first trial. But if there's a signal there, then let us tease it out on a subsequent trial. Instead, most people will go the other way around. They'll say, let's be very purist about this, be scientifically very rigorous about it, and let's worry about, you know, let's get data that we can interpret for sure. So, you know, I may or may not be able to defend this completely in front of my colleagues, but I think you know what I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a balance here. And But and remember also that our goal is to do good science in the interest of the patient. At the end of the day, if we can do that, we can then go back and iron out the finer points, because we can do that. Whereas a drug company may say, listen, I'm going to have so much money to spend on one trial, it's got to be the right trial, and then I need FDA approval on this basis. And the FDA may tell them exactly how to do it. I don't want this confounding issue if you were to start the drug right away or within a week of them being on another drug. So the FDA can dictate this. We don't have anybody dictating to us. The only people mm-hmm. dictating to us are the patients. So there's a lot of freedom that we have in an interesting kind of way in what we're trying to do.
Right, and the most important thing is that for us, even if the trial fails, it is a success, because we have, as we said before, we have proved that something didn't work.
Right.
So that's not the case for the drug companies. They really have to make sure that their trial succeeds.
Right, right. And that's certainly very important to the patients. To learn what doesn't work is at least as important as learning what does work.
Right. I mean, obviously, we would like successful trials that work for all of us, but mm-hmm. a failed trial is actually still a very precious amount of information for that patient.
Right. You learn not to waste your money and your time on something that's not likely to be beneficial. Now, in the case of most sort of epidemiological trials, you know, finding out what might reduce your chances of cancer over time, seems like you need a particularly big population to do that, right?
Both a relatively large population, usually, and also long periods of time. And so,
right, like the Framingham Heart Study, for example, taking a baby aspirin for every day for years and years, does that really help you or not? And the only way they could prove that was to have a very large number of people over many, many years.
Correct. And that's the reason that we are unlikely initially to embark on those sort of prevention trials. They're very important, but it's just not a niche that I think we'll get into for starters, just because there's so much to be done on the therapeutic end.
Right, but maybe collecting data, as you said, from people who've been taking statins for other reasons.
Correct.
And somehow collecting that data and analyzing the data, crunching those numbers, you get some very interesting learning out of it if we can somehow add those together.
Oh, yes. No, we will take clues from anywhere, and a lot of that work has already been done. It's just being ignored, that's all.
Because it's not profitable enough.
Well, because if you're going to really put it to a test, somebody's got to fund it.
Okay. So the inferences that can be made from the existing studies are not compelling enough?
Well, they were not powered.
No need to be made.
They were not powered necessarily for that purpose. So in other words, they're observational studies as opposed to interventional ones. So if somebody finds that, for example, there was a very curious observation of patients with breast cancer made years ago. This is all written in peer-reviewed journals. These were breast cancer patients who also had heart disease. And they were on a drug that was particularly popular in those days and still is used quite a bit and to increase the efficiency of the heart's pumping ability, and the drug is called Digoxin. And they found that patients on Digoxin who also had breast cancer were less likely to die of their breast cancer.
Huh.
Now, this study has been out there for years. If you put in Digoxin and breast cancer and Google search this, which is where we ended up doing one day for reasons I won't get into. But that's what we found this study. And then there are cell culture studies. And there's also, you know, at the end of the day, is somebody going to do a study of Digoxin in breast cancer? Now, Digoxin is not a trivial drug. It's got toxicities and so on. So none of this is straightforward. I'm not necessarily advocating it. But
so don't just rush out and start taking Digoxin.
No, I wouldn't advocate that. But there are other examples like this, and
mm-hmm.
So the correct study then to do would be not an observational one, but what's called an interventional one. In other words, take half the people who you see and, you know, give them Digoxin, and the other half you don't, and see if that makes a difference in terms of their outcomes, and so on. So there are lots of observations like this, but it requires lots of money to really bring this to a final conclusion. But then from a therapy standpoint, there's some very interesting studies on Digoxin for acute therapy, that is for actually for actually regressing a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And that also, there's some interesting anecdotal reports about, but never been tested carefully.
Now, you mentioned also using some of these compounds for neoadjuvant trials. What is a neoadjuvant trial?
So a neoadjuvant trial is a trial in which you basically, the typical situation is a cancer patient who is slated to undergo surgery. It might be a breast cancer in which it's thought that there's no evidence of metastatic disease, so this is locally invasive tumor. It might be a prostate patient, might even be a pancreatic cancer patient. So these are people who have had a biopsy, have a diagnosis of cancer, and typically there are 2 or 3 weeks that go by in which before which they undergo the definitive surgical procedure. So a neoadjuvant therapy is a therapy given before the surgery and after the diagnosis. And it can be used for a number of things. So one thing it can be used for is to see if the therapy that you are, because you get tissue afterwards from the definitive surgery, you get tissue, is to compare before and after. So during those 2 to 3 weeks, you could put a patient on a certain drug and ask what happens. And you get very useful information coming out the other end because you know the patient's going to undergo the surgery. Ultimately, how this drug gets used in the clinic, it could, for example, be used to lower the, for example, instead of a mastectomy, the patient may then get away with a lumpectomy if the right chemotherapeutic drug is given as a neoadjuvant. So those are the kind of uses that this kind of therapy is put to. But it can also be used to get an idea of whether a drug over 2 to 3 weeks is doing anything because you have access to tissue before and after.
Right, so you could see if it managed to go down to the cellular level and get the response inside the tumor that you were hoping for.
That's correct.
So that's a good way to get an early indicator if this drug is probably going to be active or is unlikely to be active.
So you'll find there are a lot of drug companies and others who engage in these sorts of studies.
Right. Right. And you mentioned, too, foods, herbs, supplements, fish oil, flaxseed oil, green tea.
Well, so what we're doing is we're, first of all, gathering the literature.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're dividing the literature into what has been done in the laboratory and what's been done in patients and what the mechanisms are. So if you look at something like, let's say, green tea, for example, there are hundreds of papers on a number of compounds that exist in green tea. Even though there are hundreds of papers, there are actually several compounds, a handful of them, that have been looked at in some detail. And so we may end up focusing on the compound itself or on the green tea, but it'll move up or down the ladder of being prioritized for clinical trials based on these criteria. For example, there's already a phase 2 trial, and what's really hurting is that there's no phase 3. That may move up on the agenda. If there's better mechanistic understanding, that moves up on the agenda. So at the moment, what we're doing is we literally want to raise some funds to start getting a smart group of people together around one or more of these to give us opinions, and to then say, what are the next steps? Do we need to do more experiments in the lab, or is this really ready to go?
One of the interesting things about foods is that what you see in the lab may or may not translate if you're just taking it by mouth, because if it goes through your digestive system, is this critical element that we saw in the lab really getting to where it needs to go?
Yeah, so a very good example of that is a compound that exists. It's a pure compound. It's called curcumin. And curcumin is what gives the Indian spice turmeric its orange-yellow color.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go on the internet, you will see hundreds and hundreds of articles on curcumin, especially as they relate to cancer.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of mechanistic understanding. We know how curcumin works in many different ways, it turns out. The bad news is, and this wasn't figured out till very, very recently, is that if you take curcumin by mouth, and we happen to be from India, so when Vidula cooks, there's a lot of curcumin in our food.
Right.
We use it as a spice. And so we will ingest a gram of curcumin a day, for example. Now, it turns out that there's very little that goes in the blood. And it's kind of a shame, but until recently, there was essentially nothing published on the pharmacokinetics. In other words, how much is orally bioavailable? How much is in the blood when you eat a gram or two, you know, half a teaspoon of curcumin? Mm-hmm. And it's a shame because then people have actually done some trials with curcumin and they haven't worked. So it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean it's good. It doesn't mean it's bad. It doesn't, just doesn't mean anything.
Right, so, but in fact, this fine element that's really the active element needs to be taken as an injection or something in order to get where it needs to go.
That's right. So one approach is to take it as an injection and reformulate that drug, basically as an injection. Another would be to mix it with other things that might increase its oral bioavailability, and you get more into the blood that way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are other foods that you need to take. Some people are swearing up and down that if you mix it with coconut oil and heat the coconut oil, there's more curcumin in your blood. Well, one of the things Global Cures may do, in fact, is very interested in doing, is doing a series of these simple trials. They would be called phase one trials, in which we just see if any of this stuff makes any sense. And this would not cost millions of dollars. This, you know, we could do the curcumin trial and do the things that are on the internet or have reason to believe that may work, literally for, you know, $100,000. And sooner than later, we are going to be putting these on the web saying, look, we would like to raise $100,000 to do a trial of curcumin under the following conditions. We'll do a dose escalation. We'll give this much, this much, this much, and we'll mix it with this, this, and this. And, you know, we'll find out how much is in the blood over time. It's a simple trial. Somebody just needs to do it.
Right. Well, if there's someone out there listening who would like to help you with this, how do they go about reaching you and helping?
So our website is www.global-cures.org. This is all about powerful patients, so we want to thank you, Joyce, you know, for hosting us. We believe in the power of the patients, and we're hoping that we can return you know, something back to them, which is really
thank you, and I hope that you'll work out ways of helping us volunteer to be part of some of these efforts. And I think it's great that you're going to be putting protocols and feedback mechanisms on the web that patients and their local doctors can participate in. That would be great. Thank you.
Pretty exciting stuff. And thank you all for being with us today and participating in this very interesting talk. And we hope that you'll come back next week and join us again. Be well and be a powerful patient.